A lot of us move into an empty space to live, but it takes much more before we can begin to call it a home. We bring to the apartment or house our own sense of space and try to meld it with what someone else designed a year or 100 years ago. We're drawn to areas of town or to certain houses where we feel comfortable. My guest today on Fresh Air is writer Philip Langdon, one of a few journalists who explores what it is that makes some spaces work and others fail. Philip Langdon writes about the American home in a regular column for The Atlantic, where he's written on new trends in retirement homes, closet space, kitchen design, computer smart homes, and historical renovation. Langdon is the author of American Houses and an earlier book, Orange Roofs, Golden Arches, The Architecture of the American Chain Restaurant. I asked Philip Langdon what makes where we live a home instead of just a house.
I think that what makes a difference is whether the house really fits the way people want to live. And I think that what you see now in American housing is a tendency by builders and developers to try to pay a little more attention to the differences in ways people live. One of the things that's really happened over a long period of time, I think, is that there's been this long-term trend toward informality. And as a result of the fact that we now have a lot more people who have both husband and wife out working all day long. They obviously don't have servants. They want to entertain people, and when they come home, they would like to be able to have a very convenient house in which people can get together, can talk to each other, can work in the kitchen, for instance, while having conversations. And so one of the things I think that's really important in houses is trying to get a good relationship of the rooms within the house.
Well, it seems many of these working couples use two rooms, the kitchen and the bedroom.
And I think the kitchen is very important. I think it's the more important of those two areas because in the kitchen, obviously, you've got to spend time getting meals together, and you would like to be able to have conversations, see your kids, see your husband or wife, and when you have guests over, be able to entertain them. And I think that currently there's a lot more interest in designing kitchens so that there is, in fact, a way to work in the kitchen while still talking with other people. And I've been to a lot of houses around the country, for instance, in which the kitchen is now arranged so that it's relatively open to some sort of a social area. And in fact, now you very often see in some new subdivision houses a kind of a peninsula arrangement with a sink in it, for instance, so that somebody can work at preparing food, washing glasses, fixing drinks, and face people who have come over or talk with other members of the family, rather than having always that situation of having the kitchen sink looking out the window so that you're really putting your back to the other people in the house.
Which was also in part a reflection of how the houses were lived in before, with a woman at home alone, and the window was her view out on the world.
Exactly. I mean, it is nice to have that view out, but I think that came from a period when most women were staying at home all day long, and so there was really no need to think of how are you going to design this kitchen for interaction. And now I think that there's much more of a tendency to try to do that, and I think that that's one of the advances that we're making in terms of trying to design houses that fit the way that people live their lives today.
Houses then tend to be turning inward. The focus is now more in toward the family, in toward what's actually going on in the house, rather than looking out.
I think it's ironic, actually. I mean, you see people spending an awful lot of their time at work, and you would think, therefore, that the house should be less important, and they would be getting lots of services outside. And yet, in fact, it seems as if there's this buildup of tension that has to be relieved by making the house into this almost a self-sufficient compound, to the extent that people are able to do that financially.
But that also gets to what it is we do with our money and stocking a house filled with appliances and electric gadgets with that idea of self-sufficiency.
Yeah, and so you see a lot of money going into kitchens, into making them much more elaborate. And then when you ask people how do they really use them, what really gets used an awful lot during the week is is the microwave. And then on the idea, though, is to have as much as you can to do really large-scale things on weekends. The other part of the house, it seems to me, that's gotten a lot more emphasis in the last several years is the bedroom area. And currently there's a lot of interest in creating master bedroom suites, which are very elaborate. The bathroom, which used to very often be a 5x7 or 5x8, relatively small area, utilitarian, is becoming much more lavish.
I was in a house the other day that had one of these master suites, and it had an enormous bed in it, and the right at the foot of the bed was the shower, and the shower was large enough for two people, and it was completely glassed in so that you could be in bed there and watch your spouse, companion, taking a shower.
Mm-hmm.
Bedroom is an entertainment center, I guess.
I guess it is, a certain type of entertainment, and I think that there's this tremendous fantasy element that goes into the design of these bedroom suites. I mean, I think that most of them are not realistically designed in terms of the more expensive ones. I have talked with people, you know, they put in the big Whirlpool tub, and you ask them a year later, well, do you use it? And they said, well, we've used it about three times. You know, it takes a long time to fill the thing up, and we're pretty busy, so we take showers around here. But yeah. it's still there's an awful lot of image that goes into designing houses, and I think that the image is really driving a lot of what is being done in houses today. People would like to be able to show off just how well they're living. And so they would like to have all these wonderful things, even if they don't actually use them that much.
Well, you've admired the front porch for a long time, and in particular a development in Seaside, Florida, where front porches were mandated by the zoning code. And what was your experience in seeing, were these front porches actually used?
They were used occasionally, but I thought it was interesting in walking around Seaside. I spent about 4 days there, seeing that when people sat out on their porches, they tended to sit really on their side porches. And when they went to architects, very often now they're asking for rear porches, because although they like this old-fashioned idea of sociability, really what they'd like is a good deal of privacy. And so I think people still would like to be able to turn away from the public street when they're going to socialize with some friends.
I'm speaking with Philip Langdon. He writes about architecture and home design and is the author of the book American Houses. Well, Jane Jacobs was writing in the 1960s about the need to keep people on the streets, that streets are safest when more people use them, and porches lent an aura of neighborhood security. People out on the porches could see what was going on in the neighborhood. You're suggesting there's a turn toward the house as a hideout versus the house as a friendly, neighborly place, part of a community.
I think you see the house as a hideout, especially in California and a good deal of the Sun Belt. And you see it especially in areas where the houses are built on very tight lots, and the attempt is to create this area away from everybody else at the back of the house. I think there's still a lot of regional variation around the country. And I think that if you go through the Midwest, and I've spent a week, for instance, in the Chicago suburbs, I was sort of surprised to see that, quite in contrast to what you see in California and the Sun Belt, you still see houses that are pretty much exposed to their neighbors. In terms of when somebody's in the backyard, you're pretty much on public view of your neighbors. The houses do front on the streets. And so I think we have a lot of ideas that vary regionally, and there's really a lot of debate going on now about whether we should have more of a kind of a public consciousness, try to put more life into the public realm. One of the nice things about the town of Seaside is that although people weren't out on those front porches a lot, you can still see the people on their side porches. And in fact, the streets themselves were designed with picket fences fairly close to the house, so that you felt that you were in this special area that was very well defined. The streets were relatively narrow and had that feeling of being kind of an outdoor room, and people like to walk down the streets. I think when you build very wide streets, people don't want to walk down those streets. It gets to feel like just a big void. And there are a number of designers around the country who are trying to orient the house so that, yes, it will provide some privacy that you need, but it's also going to try to create a more inviting public environment and make it possible for people to walk, for instance, from their home to some of the services that they need, to do some shopping, for instance, without always having to drive.
You've quoted a British town planner as saying, a place without old buildings is like a person without a memory. Are developers trying to put instant history into new projects when they build houses that are throwbacks, they look like colonial, they look like Tudor? What is it that's attracting customers?
Well, I think that people get a tremendous amount of comfort out of housing that goes back to something that they've seen in the past. And I was amazed just last week to get a publication from the remodeling industry group at the National Association of Home Builders, which you'd think would be the last group that would be really interested in doing things in an old-fashioned way. And the illustration that they sent, the project that they featured, was a 1950s one-story house that the remodeler managed to turn into something that was a two-story house that looked like it had been built about 1900. I think that first of all, people admire the craftsmanship that they associate with those older houses. And they also, I think, carry in their heads a vision of these houses of being places that were really home, that have an emotional resonance, that something brand new and radically different from the past is not able to deliver.
When people say, I want a home, what are they talking about? What to them do you think is in the mind about a home? What makes a home a home?
I think that they want a safe place, a place where they can feel comfortable with their immediate family, where they can have friends over. I think that there's a sense of solace that comes out of home. And so I think that people really are trying to make their houses comfortable and warm places. And at the same time, though, they would really like to be able to do something that the people that that they hang around with will also respect. And so I think that they're, in a way, they are driven by two conflicting things. One is to just make that house comfortable and make it a good place for their family life. And the other is to make it something that is going to meet the expectations that they think other people have for them. And as a result, for instance, you see a lot of emphasis now on doing fairly elaborate foyers for some of the more expensive houses, even though hardly any time is spent in the foyer, obviously.
But it is that grand attempt at status.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few of them. For instance, they're two stories tall. They very often have a second floor window so that you have light coming in. I mean, they're really very nice, but hardly practical. You could use the space in much more practical ways. But I think that a lot of people are driven by this need to do something that is going to be an expression of how far they've come in life.
And that's always been part of the American dream.
It has been, but it seems to me that the need seems somehow to be more intense. It's been more intense for the last few years. I think people have felt that they ought to be making good money, they ought to be living good lives, and they ought to be able to show that. And I think that in the last several years, it's been okay. People have felt that it's been okay to make more of a show of how well you're doing. And that's made quite an impact, I think, on, say, the upper half of the housing market. We still have a lot of so-called affordable houses in which we don't see this big show being made. But I think that...
But nevertheless, it is a show even nowadays to be able to own a house.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's very tough to do it.
I mean, there's the question, do you own or are you a renter? I mean, there's a real distinction. I once had an encounter with a neighbor of mine, and we were having a discussion about what to do about the fence and talking with the contractor that the neighbor had brought in. And she said, don't pay any attention to him. He's just a renter.
That's
and here,
true.
Right in the midst of a neighborhood, was this very keen class distinction that was drawn.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's that says something really about this whole problem of housing affordability. I think that there's a lot of lip service paid to producing affordable houses, but in fact, those who already have houses really don't want the price of houses to go down very much. They like the idea that, they're having an appreciation of the value of their real estate. And I think that there's this kind of a economic class consciousness, and people really think that they have reached the level of owning a house, and they're not eager to change, say, the zoning regulations to allow smaller houses into their neighborhoods.
It's a matter of, I've got mine now. You'll just have to struggle as much.
Exactly. Or more, because actually many of the people who now own houses bought them when the prices were considerably lower. I think it's one of the big issues that, we haven't worked out in our minds yet, because people who are buying houses are buying investments, and they would like to make the most of that investment over time.
Well, that is an interesting switch from a house just a shelter to a tax shelter.
Yeah, well, the house really is so many different things for people. I mean, it's the biggest way that people save money in this country. And people want to profit by that investment. This is a safe place to put their money, and they can enjoy what they've put their money in a way that they certainly can't with a certificate of deposit.
What developments do you admire?
Well,
for instance, you've written about a development east of San Francisco near Danville called Blackhawk, a region of phenomenally expensive homes.
That was not one I admired.
That was not one you admired. How come?
That was. A prime representation, I think, of the ostentation that you see at the top of the housing market of trying to make the roofs as complex as you can, to incorporate as many rich-looking entries into the houses, to sort of get all of the visible manifestations of wealth onto those houses. But at the same time, it seemed to me that there was no sense of community in that place. Every house was actually carved onto a hillside pad, a flat piece of land, and then you had
a bulldozed out flat on the hill.
Despite all the environmental progress that's been made, that kind of thing is still very common. Blackhawk was not one of the places that I liked. One of the places I did like was a place called Davis, California, or Village Homes in Davis, California. And in this development, the idea was to do a development that, first of all, would be energy conscious. Many of the houses are solar houses and built in a very energy efficient manner. Second, they tried not to pipe all of the water underground and have really elaborate works of civil engineering. Instead, they managed to put some of the stormwater runoff on the surface in just grassy or gravel ditches, and actually in an area where there are little kids. I mean, kids love to play in things like that. And they saved something like $800 per house by doing this. Then they could take the $800 savings per house, and they could put in a lot more landscape. And as a result of that, they could put in they had a large number of fruit trees they put in, and then they instituted a program whereby the community took responsibility for these, and teenage kids and others could take care of the harvesting and care of the fruit trees, and they could therefore earn some money with which to support some athletic facilities within the complex. And it seemed to me that one thing sort of fed into another. They had a sense of...
It got back to that idea of a common green, where people would sort of moor their cows, let their cows graze all in common.
Yeah, I think that there was a sense of community that came both from the environment and from the kinds of shared landscape and the uses that they could make of that shared landscape. And I think that that's still relatively rare, but I think that it's something that's worth shooting for.
My guest is Philip Langdon, author of the book American Houses. We'll talk more about what makes a place after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Langdon. He's written extensively about home design for many publications, and he's the author of the book American Houses. He's also written about American chain restaurants in the book Orange Roofs, Golden Arches. You seem to have an affection for the designs of the 50s, those root beer hamburger stands and the car hops. Was there more of a community in those kinds of fast food places?
There was a kind of a community, but it was a pretty boisterous community. I mean, the reason that we don't have a lot of those places is that after a while, all the neighbors got together and tried to close them down or limit their hours. It was a community, but they left a lot of litter, and they were very noisy. Some of them really, really produced an interesting evening life that was not so boisterous, and I kind of miss that.
So was this part of the vision of a chain like McDonald's to try and keep teenagers from gathering?
Oh, they always wanted to do that. And then ultimately, I think the reason, one half of the reason that they introduced seating indoors was to get all those people out of the parking lot where they were making a lot of noise and revving up their engines and get them inside so that they would consume their meals and get on their way.
Which is part of the idea of fast food, move the people out quickly, mm-hmm. along with those hamburgers.
Volume is everything.
At one time, chains like McDonald's were expanding it. I think you wrote one new outlet every 17 hours?
I think that's about right. And McDonald's still is. They just do a phenomenal business. And because they have everything worked out to a really scientific level of production. And in fact, it goes all the way back really to the McDonald brothers, Richard and Maurice, who back in the early 1950s were pioneering their chain. And they had worked out this thing so that they could serve a customer in 20 seconds. And this was before Ray Kroc ever came along, just by standardizing the menu and standardizing all the operations, getting all of the equipment in the exact right spot in the restaurant so that there would be absolutely not one step needed in beyond the minimum, and, of course, getting the customer to take things away himself.
Part of the success of the McDonald's has been, and all of these chain restaurants, has been their identifiability. You can drive down a commercial strip anywhere and you might know what it is you're getting into. Yet there have been cities that have fought this look. In Vancouver, San Francisco, other cities I've seen, these chain stores are now forced to blend into a community style. Does this seem to be going on throughout the country, the community is sort of taking back control through zoning regulations?
I think it's happening in places that are populated by pretty affluent and well-educated people. It's happening in historic areas. I think it's happening in cities, especially large cities. But you can still go down the strip and you can still see that same image building repeated thousands of times as you drive across the country. I think that in general, this effort to try to get something that relates to the community is a good one. The hardest thing, I guess, is to get the chain to really put a significant amount of work into it rather than doing something that is just very easy to get through. For instance, McDonald's came up with a series of simple facade variations on their standard building so that they do a so-called Tudor, they had quite a number of different variations, and it looks like wallpaper on the exterior of their standard building. Now, that I think is not really producing the kind of relationship to the existing community that is good in, I think, any kind of a commercial development.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back into the house and far into the house. You recently wrote an article for Atlantic in your home column on the notion of closets, of storage space, as the last sanctuary of American life. I mean, that's where we kept our skeletons, and that's where some people chose to come from. And now we're inviting people in to help us organize our closets. What's going on here?
Well, I think one thing that has gone on is that millions of women decided they weren't going to stay home all day. They were going to go to work. And when they went out to work, there was obviously there was less time available to clean up after everybody in the family. So therefore, you have to have more storage space because you're talking about a bigger wardrobe with both the man and the woman, I think, going off to work every day, and less time to get everything in order. And so there's been this. Now there are several companies around. Several companies around that are specializing in coming into your house and reorganizing your closets so that everything is organized, so that you can see everything and get more use out of the existing closet space. Rather than, for instance, the old idea was you simply had a shelf with a pole, and of course the short things and the long and long things both hung from that same pole and.
Both overcoats and jackets.
And so you wasted a lot of space. Now the tendency is to try to subdivide the closet and get a lot of stuff into that closet. I think everybody, it seems that people have more and more things, and the problem is, where are you going to put them?
What have you done about your own house? Are you in your dream house?
Well,
is it a home for you?
Yes. Oh, I love it. We're in a house. We're in an old house. I love old houses, and we have one built in 1911, which someone came along in 1952 and did the back in thermopane modern. And so it's one of these houses with a split personality that looks like a 1911 classical revival house on the street. But in fact, you come in and you have 20 feet of thermopane glass looking out onto the backyard.
Do you have enough closet space?
We do, fortunately. We've got lots of storage.
Well, Philip Langdon, thank you very much for coming in and spending some time with us here today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Philip Langdon's books include American Houses and Orange Roofs, Golden Arches, The Architecture of American Chain Restaurants, and he also writes a regular column, Home, that appears in The Atlantic Magazine. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.